Welcome to the Legion Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Legion on FX. I'm Jason.
And I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And this is Legion Podcast Episode 7, the penultimate episode. And before we start, I just want to know, if you guys were locked in a coffin, how long would you scream and pound on the underside of the lid?
0 seconds, I think. Like, actually, it would happen in reverse order of how it happened here. Like, I would go, this is a bad situation. I'm going to try and find a way out. And then, like, an hour in, once I realized it's not happening, then I would start screaming and pounding.
Yeah, I've done a lot of spelunking in my youth, and I've been in situations where I've been temporarily confined and couldn't move and kind of realized it, and I had to have a whole inner monologue of, don't freak out. People freak out or end up dying. You're going to be fine. Just keep wiggling. And it's also like, when I see stuff like that, it makes me feel physically uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like every once in a while, I've also, like when I'm playing football, I get underneath a dog pile, not be able to move. And it does, it really freaks me out. And I have to really concentrate not to the fucking flip. So I think, I don't know, it'd be a war between, you know, the rational British part of my mind and the animal that just wants to get the fuck out of this box. So
Next week, it'll be the rational versions of all of us, by the way, in our British accents. So look forward to that.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Because I can't hold British, but for 5 seconds, it slips to either Australian or Scotch.
Mine is just some unidentifiable mishmash.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into our top three. Top three highlights, season one, episode seven, chapter seven. What do you guys think in general?
In general, I thought it was really good. I enjoyed this one a lot.
Yeah, I thought this episode is awesome. I thought it felt very comic booky in the best kind of way, and a lot of the like I thought it was really clever the way they did the multiple chalkboards that kind of suggests like a panel style for a comic book page, and you know, all the nods to the X-Men continuity, and you know, also the fact that they did the big reveal, which is something I'd kind of guessed a few, you know, quite a few episodes ago. Like, maybe that's part of my frustration with the middle part of the season, that it just felt like it was him and Han for no good reason. But everything came together, and I thought it was awesome. It was awesome to see David become powerful. The way they kind of ended the standoff with time, I thought was pretty cool. I don't have much bad to say about this episode at all.
Yeah, it's interesting because this whole time the tension of like where you might find yourself unsatisfied is not quite knowing what's going on. And this episode was probably the most straightforward of any we've seen so far, and it really resolved that. It just felt good to have something a little more solid, but that wouldn't have felt as good if the whole rest of the series hadn't been so shaky.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Well, I liked it too. I thought it was really super imaginative, which I'm going to get into in my top three. There was even a part of me that was like, it doesn't quite feel like Legion because I understand what's going on.
But, okay. I didn't get that.
But I liked it. All right. Top three. Jim, why don't you go first?
Let's start off with the rational mind. I actually like the scenes with his rational mind quite a bit. I thought it was a pretty good joke that the rational mind is British. And I really like the imagery that they use there when he's in the coffin and kind of his rational mind slides in from the other direction. And it illustrates kind of the difference between their mental states, right? They're completely opposite here. Mm-hmm. They're head to toe.
And not only that, but part of the rational mind's function was to say, you don't need to be confined in this coffin. See, I'm over here.
Right. Yep. And I mean, you know, it wasn't all perfect. I thought maybe it was a little too, it's a pretty serious breakthrough for him in the span of 2 minutes with his rational mind to say, I'm not sick anymore. Yeah. I mean, maybe that is the nature of a breakthrough, but it seemed a little sudden for me, and a little too concrete.
They also explain it as like his the physical manifestation of his powers on the astral plane. Like, your brain is so powerful that it's like resisting this effort to be contained, and this is the easy to digest version of how that's manifesting itself. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, and I'm ready to roll with comic book power within reason if I understand how it works. So I didn't have that problem, but I can see where you would. Because it was sudden. Like, he didn't spend a commercial break in that coffin before he started figuring shit out.
It felt a little bit like, it's episode 7. There's only 8 this season. is going to better figure this all out.
Well, it also sets up the tension at the end of the episode because guess what? You know, the parasite's locked in the same coffin. How long is it going to take for it to figure out? By the end of the episode, not very damn long. Doesn't seem like it.
Some people seem to think that he deliberately went in there to let it out. But I didn't get that in the moment.
That is a possibility that I think is exciting. The fact that, like, maybe a path forward in season two is he still has the Shadow King locked inside of him and he has to negotiate. It's almost turns it into an Incredible Hulk situation.
Right.
Where, like, when Bruce Banner would prefer to keep the Hulk under lock and key, but sometimes, you know, well, Bruce doesn't have control, but even when he would, there's sometimes where, you know, the fucking aliens come out of the wormhole and you gotta unleash him. You gotta unleash the big green guy. I think it would be cool to have Aubrey Plaza kind of like locked away and let off the leash at certain key awesome points in the series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be good to find a way to keep her in the series too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would certainly not want him to be so carefully locked away that, like, Aubrey Plaza just couldn't, you know, Lenny just couldn't intrude into the real world any, you know, whenever it would be dramatically or comedically beneficial, like, you know, but have her kind of declawed until they let him off the hook. And then that would also probably kick off a crisis too. Like, I'm already, I guess, trying to write season two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like the thing that's interesting for me about this, and with David kind of getting more into his right mind here, is it sets up an actual battle between two people, you know, two entities that are a little more equal than what we've seen before. David didn't even understand what was going on before. Now he does, and now he can fight it. Mm. And I think that's going to be an interesting battle for David's head, essentially.
That is interesting. Right after he saw in his mind's eye his father waging that fight, then he kind of empowered him to do the same thing. All right. Aaron, what's your number three?
I thought that I feel like I can be accused of kind of being wishy-washy on this, but I thought that the style of the ultimate confrontation where Oliver started weaving his verbal spell with, I forget what that piece of music's called.
Bolero, I think.
Bolero, that's it. Mm-hmm. And, like, it turned into, like, a silent movie score to that. I thought that was a really clever, and I don't know, because I don't know why it drove me crazy the last time they dropped out the volume, and I know you and Jim liked that a lot, and I was kind of lone dissent. But this, and just kind of leaning into the silent movie style, that, and also kind of built from the Oliver's glasses, the way they visualize that being black and white, it kind of felt like everything organically wove together. And even the title cards for the silent movie sequences were inspired by the weird green and purple blocks from the credit sequence, and like kind of fourth wall breaking. But I thought that, I mean, it was just an incredible sequence. I love to see, like, superpowers visualized, and, like, Oliver's, like, I guess, kinetic spell he was weaving out of, like, words, and I thought that was really cool. And David, like, flexing his power and blowing through those doors and was really cool. And you know, then the Shadow King just rolling up the eyeball into a little basketball.
Oh, man.
that was
appropriately horrifying and cool. So, like, I feel like that was the absolute pinnacle of the episode and the season. I think this is the best episode of the season, and that was the best scene of the episode. So that was my highlight. And we could probably go on and on about all the little touches and details that they put in there.
Why do you think she did that to Walter? Just done with him.
I think she was going to do that to everyone.
I'm done with you. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like that. She, like, you know, tormenting the bad guy is ultimately not as satisfying as tormenting the pure innocence. So, like,
yeah,
she. It's almost like this guy's a lesser devil and she's Satan. It's like, hey, you're a little too much into the pitchforks and hellfire. That's my job, you know.
Yeah,
like, I can't have you terrorizing Carrie. That's my job.
Well, I'll go into my. I'm going to switch order here, but one of mine was just imaginative things in this episode. The whole show takes place largely in the mind, so there's so many possibilities, and I think the show does a great job of exploring that. And there was just in this episode a bunch of different things, like you mentioned, conducting this bullet shield of words to the tune of Bolero. I love that. The chalkboard animations, the even the globe room at the beginning that was sort of an evil control room or something that, you know, the demon was kind of monitoring the situation, and walking around this frozen time room with a streaming bullet and the sparks kind of just moving at a really slow pace. The bullets are still turning. I love that. But I actually thought, I wasn't sure, the silent movie scene, I on one hand really enjoyed it, but I felt like this kind of stuff, there's a part of me that's like, is it getting a little self-indulgent? Like, like, are they doing it just because they're like, hey, anything goes and this might be fun? I mean, I
want, did you touch me, Jason? Did we switch bodies?
I think so. Cause I want it to at least make sense in the story universe somewhat. And the silent movie cards, I wasn't sure, like, who's seeing that? You know, my rational mind came in. It just has an American accent, but it was just like, who's seeing that? Why is this happening? You know, it took me out of it just a little bit, even though it was a very enjoyable scene. It reminded me, this is probably too old, but did you guys, either one of you, watch Moonlighting with Bruce Willis?
No.
Well, there was a part like a few seasons in where they just kind of walked off the edge of the set and suddenly you could see all the cameras and lights and everything. And it reminded me of that, where it was very clever and fun, but also it just kind of felt like, does it feel like nothing matters anymore because they're just doing things for the hell of it? So I don't know. I was of two minds on that, but I think probably I should just let it go and enjoy it and let them, because you can tell they're having a ton of fun with all of this and they're being really imaginative about it.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from on that. I felt a twinge of that too, but I think ultimately I come down on the side with Aaron this time, which is, you know, I thought it was more interesting than it was taking me out of the show. Mm-hmm. So,
and you know,
ultimately it worked for me, but I get what you're saying.
I totally feel that way about, and I'm going to talk more about this later, but Oliver's character, it takes me out of it that it's basically Jemaine Clement doing his comedy, but I love Jemaine Clement's comedy. So I'm like, I like it. I don't care if it takes me out of it a little bit.
Yeah. And I just to defend my paradoxical point here, I feel like anytime something happens in the astral plane, it's automatically less offensive to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and to the extent that they established that David's old childhood bedroom was a real place this episode, that still kind of irks me, because I felt like they violated a lot of, you know, kind of rules when they did that, because I did see people melt out of mirrors and all kinds of fantastic. Now, I mean, obviously there's the boundary between what's real and what's not is kind of hazy when you're dealing with psychic people, but to the extent that something's taking place in a dreamscape, I'm fully on board with like going crazy and exploring that. But and that's probably why I didn't like the sound dropping off just for effect, and I felt that was a little masturbatory in a previous episode, where this has felt like, you know, avant-garde for with a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes me sound more rational, if that makes me sound more British or not, but there it is.
Well, while we're talking about it, it seems like we all really like the style of this episode. Because, you know, my number two is actually some of the effects in the episode and how good they were. Talk about the chalkboard animations. And we talked about the eye briefly and him being crumpled up in the astral plane. But one thing I didn't expect is when he would come back and he's just gushing in blood, covered head to toe, and then they crumple him up on the floor in real life.
Your brain makes it real, Jim.
I guess so. Makes it really fucking real.
Where's Trinity? We needed to ensure her to give him a lip lock and give him the jaws of life. And
that really got me, just that little bit at the end there.
Yeah, that was really, really fucking crazy. Like, it's like he's the house in Poltergeist. He's just like warping into himself.
And it looks really good. I mean, well done. Even though it was gross. And then I guess in the real world, though, it's the guy, he was inhabiting Rudy's body or disguised as Rudy, and his face is bleeding, but He wasn't crumpling in the real world, was he?
No, oh, when yeah. they came, when they fully he came did. Back after the time came back and David caught the bullets.
Yep.
Then he
yeah, did. Showed him like rolling up like the witch, wicked witch of the West after the house dropped on her. She was just it was that was another bizarre choice because I'm with you. Like he can bleed out of every one of his orifices because of psychic trauma, but like literally having his joints crack and fold and break like that, I don't see what the mechanism is.
If you had that power, you could just work at a recycle center or something. Or an impact.
Oh yeah,
right.
I think of Dr. Manhattan when he like you know takes apart that tank and just like think what he could do for the environment if he would just go over landfills and just like separate
smash them there.
You know he could separate them all into their yeah. like pure elemental forms. Like look at all this copper.
Yeah, forget magnetic, non-magnetic.
Yeah,
we'll just yeah take it apart by atom.
Shit, yeah, mm-hmm. silica, gold, all that. Like he you know. He'd be the real Captain Planet, but instead he goes to Vietnam and explodes Vietnamese people.
Right, that's not
misuse,
cool.
Basic misuse of his powers, man.
Aaron, number two.
Is it my turn? Yep. Okay. I hope you guys. I'm gonna trust that you're not gonna snipe my last topic, because I got some big implication stuff to discuss at the end. But I made some predictions last week about like Oliver making use of psychic technology and speaking of masturbatory, I really liked it when some of that stuff came to fruition, like that the suit and the glasses that he had constructed in the dreamscape mm-hmm. were ways to give people without his powers the ability to manifest like some protection, like they're these psychic talismans. And the way they visualize those working, like a literal deep sea diving suit is protecting you from the rigors of traveling in the psychic plane and keeping you safe from the Shadow King. And the fact these glasses can reveal the illusions around you. I thought that was really cool and very well realized. My only gripe is I don't understand why they revealed Lenny as Aubrey Plaza. Like I was really hoping that they would see either a new aspect of like what the true Aruk Vahal or what the hell is his name?
Amal Farouk.
Amal Farouk. Like some other person we haven't seen before that we like understand might be the real quote unquote real Shadow King, whatever the hell that would mean. Or have him revert to the yellow blob. The yellow-eyed devil, because it seemed inconsistent that to the extent that Lenny is not real, quote-unquote, why looking at her with these black and white glasses wouldn't reveal her true aspect.
But I mean, the whole thing sort of didn't make sense to me, because if the idea of the glasses is that they're supposed to show what's real, and they're on this mental projection, I mean, nothing's real, right? Like, the hospital's not real. So that was another little thing that took me out of it just a little bit.
I mean, I think people's minds would be real to the extent that if you roll with the Matrix residual self-image philosophy. But you're right, the escape itself, what would that even look like? Mm-hmm. I guess because when David was traversing the wild astral plane, it looked like just a flat, featureless, fog-ridden scape, right? Yeah. I guess that's what you're right. I didn't go far enough in my criticism there, Jason.
We switched bodies, so what are you gonna
in
do?
In fact, you know what? Fuck it. This episode sucked. Oh, no.
Oh, we switched back.
It only lasts so long.
Uh-huh. Okay. My turn, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think. So my number two is we got some confirmations of things that we'd already talked about, and they'd kind of been even some.
God damn it, you were not supposed to tread on my third point there. We made a gentleman's agreement.
Jump in whenever you want. So yeah. Carrie confirms that we got some revelations too, but here's some confirmations. Carrie confirms that Oliver manifested his cryogenic state into this literal ice cube, which we had talked mm-hmm. about. That the monster possessed David for revenge against his father and poisoned his whole life, made him crazy, fed on his powers. Oliver said the monster had been spending all his energy tricking David and had also been getting stronger over the years. So this sort of helps explain why now is the time for him to come out. Also, there was something about because of Sid David woke up to it. And so all those things together kind of help explain why he'd been hiding out this whole time. But now's the time to act. One thing, one of the listeners, Lara Willie Swink, said, if you go back to episode one montage, when you see toddler David sitting on the floor, just as you see the scene dissolve, the toy that looks like the Shadow King begins to turn on its own on the floor, just like we see the chalkboard Shadow King turning the doll in David's diagram. Mm. I think going back to the beginning, you'd probably catch a lot of stuff like that in this show.
I think right.
Holly planned it all out. Here's some of the revelation. Oh, wait. Sid said that they had to distract the monster, quote, who looks like Lenny but isn't. So that implies that there is actually a Lenny apart from the monster, if she's right about that. You don't think so?
I think it's a weak implication.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
That's how she knows it, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
okay, yeah.
You know, is Ace Ventura the white devil, or is that just how they know him?
Oliver said he read David's mind when he was there, so that implies he's a telepath. That's a revelation. And then David figuring out his history, the whole chalkboard scene. This part I feel a little bit critical of, because he's saying, I had a mom and dad, and if Lenny knew him, then he was probably a mutant like me, psychic, I'm guessing. That seems like a leap. For one thing, how does he know Lenny knew him? And if he did, then why would that make him a psychic mutant? And then he assumed that his dad fought the monster and won, and the monster's body didn't survive, but his mind did. I mean, there were a lot of leaps that didn't make sense to me.
British David asserted that he knows everything the monster knows, so it's more of if he can, I felt like that was a visualization of him unpeeling the layers of things that he has already known and absorbed at a subconscious basis. So some of those leaps that were right on, mm-hmm. I just took as him, like, you know, essentially uncovering the deception the Shadow King's laid on.
Got it. I mean, they presented it as if, oh, let's just logically parse right. this all out, but yeah, you're right. He did say, you know, everything.
And maybe because I went through, you know, Mr. Robot 101 and 201, I'm adept at the whole, oh, if he knows something, then I know it, and I can just fucking think hard enough to unlock that shit. But it seemed like it made sense to me.
The other thing, the chalkboard dad is, he's bald, he's psychic, he shoots psionic blasts in the astral plane. He sounds like Sean Connery, or
he's
maybe
got a chrome wheelchair with X for wheels.
Patrick
Come on.
Stewart, yeah. So
perhaps.
I feel like we could go ahead and talk about the fact that they're pretty much clearly saying that David Holler's father is Professor
Yes.
X.
I'm surprised they didn't just come out and say it here, honestly. Yeah. Like, they were hinting at it so strongly.
Sometimes I think they do that just so the fans can be smug.
I like know who that is.
Okay.
When they're dealing with their muggle family that doesn't give a fuck about, there's like, oh, you know, they can, because that is a real thing. Nerds like to feel smug now and then. I'm no exception. But I thought it was also a really nice touch because, so David's rational mind is him speaking with a British accent, but it's not quite Dan Stevens' natural accent. And I went, while I was prepping, I went and watched a couple YouTube videos of him giving interview. Mm. It was a little somewhere between, I think, his natural speaking accent and his, like, posh received British accent he uses for Cousin Matthew on Downton Abbey.
Right.
But I do think when he was kind of talking, doing his dad talk, like, that was him trying to do a Patrick Stewart, right?
Yeah, Dan Stevens doing an American guy, David doing Patrick Stewart.
Yeah. Which I thought was really was really funny in his rational mind. Like, are you trying to do it because it's, you know, it's like a reference that collapses in on itself.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Love it.
Thought that was really, really, really funny. So yeah, I'm glad we're not pussyfooting around there, because I thought it was like all but spelled out that. Yeah. Which leaves me with a lot of questions about this, you know, Summerlin's fit in with the broader mutant world. Like, you know, I feel like Professor X should be a big deal in this timeline and his school, but it's not. And I just need to not care, because, like, that will be revealed in the fullness of time. And it also, like, you don't have to have, this isn't, so this is a Fox Sony production, right? It's not any, I've been asking about whether it's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It can't be.
No.
Because Marvel doesn't
X-Men
own the
universe,
rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So it might be part of the X-Men Cinematic Universe, which I kind of doubt, but it's certainly not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right. Absolutely.
There needs to be a lot more negotiation and money paid before that happens.
The weird thing is Marvel TV is worked on by the same people. So Jeff Loeb, he's a Marvel executive. He works on the Netflix movies, which are part of the Marvel Cinematic
right.
Universe. He also
they
works
certainly,
on this.
Yeah.
So Marvel TV is more connected, at least business-wise, than Marvel movies
right.
are. But I don't. But existing within the same universe, I would say if they were going to have to pick one here, it would be the same one as the X-Men movies and not
the Marvel way
movies.
I understood it is like the Marvel movies, like everybody, even Logan gets to run the Marvel logo in front of it. But
yeah.
There's a separate Marvel Studios that is like that's where you get the MCU, and that's what runs in front of like all the MCU movies and the like Daredevils and you know Jessica Jones and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas
you can't have any mutants in the Marvel Cinematic Universe,
right?
You can't have X-Men, but you can't have Spider-Man because Sony loaned Spider-Man to them.
Right. Right. it was a hostage negotiation.
Exactly.
Did
you know,
I go
out
like,
of order?
Because 3 years ago, I would have said, fucking let Marvel have everything. But if we did that, then we wouldn't have Logan, which was awesome. And we wouldn't have Legion, which seems like it's going to be awesome. So you got to be careful what you wish for, kids.
Telling me Captain America is not a mutant.
Or Spider-Man. Like, oh, he got bitten by a radioactive spider, which completely remapped his
right.
DNA. But he's not a mutant.
No, okay. They're not. Mutants are born with their powers.
That's suspect to me.
That's the definition.
According to whom? Stanley?
So it's like,
did they say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's like, I think like I feel like mutant is a societal label and much less a scientific diagnosis in the Marvel universe.
Super soldier
like
is
gay.
Very different.
Like gay. Gay is just something that the homosexual people have embraced as the label. It doesn't mean they're necessarily happy. Well, mutants, yes, they have mutations, but Spider-Man's over there like, I'm a mutant too. Like, fuck no, you got bit by a spider, dumbass. Like, you were, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
no
perfect analogy. Because
yeah, no true mutant.
Most gay people are, you know, I would say all, are born that
way.
Whoa! So,
that's
so,
a okay. gross so, overgeneralization.
So Spider-Man is like the guy who was totally straight but had this amazing experience with, like, Johnny Depp or something and then turned.
Hey, man.
Does that make him any less gay than people who are born that way?
It's LGBTQIS for Spider-Man.
All right. I don't know where we are. I think Jim.
I think I'm up. I think I'm up for number three. Mm-hmm. So this is a bit of a negative point. And I'm sure they're going to cover it next episode, but I felt like this was the time to do it. And they kind of glossed over it. I was totally underwhelmed with the reuniting of Melanie and Oliver. I actually was surprised with how little, like, how unimportant they made it. Like, this is the most significant thing to Melanie. She should be... So they had this moment when they're in the astral plane still, right? And they're reunited. And I expected them to do some kind of version where he's, like, hitting on her. And this is kind of, like, reminiscent for her of the first time they met. That kind of thing to where it would feel... 'cause they set this up with his memory being gone. For the most part, like not even being able to remember simple words and concepts, but they like immediately move on. And then even when they're all like really safe, like they've got David's demon contained, they're outside in the real world, their bodies are safe and they're having breakfast. There's still nothing from her. And I was just waiting for the big moment and it never came.
The first thing he said was, on the chest of a barmaid in sale were tattooed the prices of ale, and on her behind, for the sake of the blind, was the same information in Braille, which was a classy
reintroduction.
That was a pretty big moment. You're right.
So I want to push back on two axes against this. Number one, I don't think they did a very good job of establishing his memory loss. That very much felt like something they invented the first episode to to somehow deal with this should being a moment for both of them, but they got better shit to do. Like, I got none in his original dealings with David that he right. was addled into brain. Like, he was maybe frozen in time, but yeah. there was nothing like, I'm struggling with basic human words, like
no,
dishes.
No, there was. There was.
Was
some.
There?
I can't remember what it was, but I guess that's yeah. sort of appropriate, given what we're talking about. But I'm okay. pretty sure there was something like that. Yeah.
But I definitely didn't get that in the
first
other
thing
scene.
Is, to the extent that he doesn't remember that she's his wife... Mm-hmm. I thought that they nailed the fact that she was being overcome with emotion, but she also is professional enough that she had shit to do. And like one of my,
but then breakfast, man. They should have talked. Mm. They should have done. She should have. It should have been a big moment for
but
her, and it didn't feel like it.
But isn't that like what she does? Like she grabs troubled mutants and slowly leads them to understand their condition and their place in
it
the
is,
world.
But
so, like,
earlier she was being blinded by her quest for to get Oliver back. Now she's suddenly not.
Yeah.
Like when she has him in her grasp, like I don't understand it.
Okay.
It felt pretty inconsistent.
From his
I
standpoint,
kinda
like,
liked it because I thought, you know, he obviously doesn't remember her, which is sort of heartbreaking for her, but at the same time she's uh-huh. really happy to see him and be near him. And so what do you do with that information? I mean, I think it would have been the typical expected thing for there to be a big dramatic moment, but instead she's just kind of hanging back and waiting for him to come around, and he's sort of slowly coming around, you know, I think I remember you, it'll come to me.
Yeah,
so,
like I said, I think they're gonna do it next episode. I just felt like yeah. it should have been bigger for her this episode. Mm-hmm. But they had a lot to do this episode.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah, this episode had the least amount of romance, I would say. So far, no, nothing between yeah. Sid and David, really.
Or right,
not much.
Hey, man, he caught the bullets for her. That was pretty romantic.
That's true. Not letting your girlfriend get killed. That was pretty awesome, too.
Yeah, I'm. What power? I mean, so is that a telekinetic power? Is that? I mean, it's got to be right. He slowed down the yeah. bullet somehow in mm-hmm. a brief instant millisecond kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're gonna. I kind of wish that they just let Oliver fucking catch him with his psychic shield. I thought that would have been boss, and the end result is the same. And like her coming to the real world to fuck. I didn't see where that came from. Like, how the hell did she happen to have a? I mean, I know this is like not literally what it is. It's just, I guess, a bit of her consciousness was aware that something was going on in the real world, but. I don't understand how she was able to see that and nip it in the bud in time. And since I think it would be cooler for Oliver to stop with the psychic shield, and ultimately it didn't matter anyway, and it was like 30 seconds of scenes otherwise, like I'm not sure why they did it. Other than I guess David had to fucking do it himself, and that's important to the story.
It was kind of fun to see Aubrey Plaza just swat Jermaine Clement away.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
Yeah, and it did give her another crazy thing to do.
I mean, one thing that confused me on first viewing was this, the guy, Rudy, who's a telekinetic, and he was drooling blood. And so mm-hmm. I kept thinking, because his face is sort of generic, in my opinion,
right.
that was the drooling guy that we've been seeing.
It is. It was.
Yeah.
Was
so
it?
That yeah. was one of my, because if you remember, I said, like, if the eye took over Rudy... Why is both the Rudy and the eye in the mental hospital, and why is Rudy a drooling idiot? And now it makes perfect sense that I put a knife in Rudy's chest and stowed him in the closet and then used mm-hmm. his chameleon power, because we saw him take over David's old
therapist
when he was at the crazy funhouse lighthouse. So that was entirely consistent with his powers and would explain why all of them were pulled into the psychic realm. So apparently what happened is Melanie... in fat slow time whispered some kind of words of encouragement to Rudy that allowed him to man up just enough to tackle the psychic king or the shadow king in the astral plane. I was relieved because it cleared up a lot of confusion I had over the last episode.
Well, one thing I like about that is we've seen this drooling guy with spittle coming down, but it's frozen in time, so I still don't totally understand it, but it relates to what ended up happening. So that's kind of
cool.
Yeah,
I think he was just unconscious and dying this whole time. Why mm-hmm. they were in a, mm-hmm. that's why he looked like he was on Klonopin or whatever.
All right. Is it? I think it's your turn, Aaron.
All right. Well, you did leave me some space to talk about the other big concept things. In the beginning, you mentioned the map room, and Aubrey Plaza was tear-assing around that, screaming, what did he do with it? What did he do with
it? Oh, yeah. Good question.
Any speculation on what, who is he and what is it?
That's a big question of this episode, and I think it's supposed to be.
I would like to advance a theory.
Okay.
To the extent that we found, we got confirmed that the Shadow King is a parasite that was a former human. Like, he wasn't like a human in the sense of like born without a body. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if like Charles Xavier didn't knock him the fuck out of his body. And like he's looking, he wants to be reunited with his original body. And he's one, when he's saying it, like, you know, you separated my consciousness from my body. You hid your child from me to keep him from having revenge. Where is it?
Well, by this time, wouldn't it be like worm food?
Unless he's frozen.
Yeah, I mean, we got Jermaine Clement's been on ice for 30 years. Like, yeah. this is the X-Men, man. He can be chilling in like what's that thing that they the prison, the Phantom Zone? Yeah, I know it's DC, but I'm sure Marvel's got an equivalent.
We got
right?
Two-Face in this episode, so
exactly. Right. And then, so the other thing I want to talk about, what became of the eye? It seems pretty clear that the eye's physical body is dead because it got wrapped up and shoved in a Samsonite luggage like so many Swedish ambassadors from the Americans. But the dude that got blown up in the first episode came back, and now he's got a milky white eye. Like, is he going to come back next season and be called Twix? Because he's graham cracker, chocolate, and caramel all mixed together. Or I should have gone with Reese's cup. Damn it. That was the one. Is he going to be called Reese because he's peanut butter and chocolate mixed together now?
We don't know his name.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's going to be Reese. I just told you. it's the eye inhabiting this guy's body. Mm. It's got to be, right?
I mean, it doesn't have to be.
David's therapist had a fucked up face and the milky white eye ended up being the eye. This guy comes back, fucked up face, milky white eye. He's going to be the eye.
Yeah, it seems like they're leaning that way.
You were right. Yeah, we should never question you after the whole Shadow King thing.
But I don't know, like, I don't know the mechanism for that to actually happen. I don't know that the eye can do that, like project himself into other people's bodies. We know that he can like appear as other people, but can he get his consciousness into someone else? I don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe David could do it, or maybe Farouk could do it. I mean, there are players on the table that could do it.
The inconsistency, I agree with you there, Jim, and I was shocked to see him come back with the milky white eye. The inconsistency there is not only did his body die in graphic fashion, but it seemed like he died on the astral plane too. So what the hell's left?
Right.
Like, I can see if your astral projection gets killed, you leave behind a drooling vegetable.
Yeah.
If your astral plane is alive and your body, physical body, gets destroyed, then you're a psychic parasite.
Yeah.
But when both of them get the Matrix treatment, then what the hell?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, in which case it's sort of frustrating and confusing to have this guy have that milky white eye and make us
because it does seem like with the language of the show, they're trying to tell us that, ooh, that's the eye.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Got to watch out for the eye. All right, so
speaking
of
the eye,
my 2 points.
Whose eyes are those up on the wall?
Is that the
eye's eye?
I'm guessing it was Lenny.
Yeah, I think so.
Lenny? Okay.
Yeah, I was trying to pay attention to Aubrey Plaza's eyes when I saw them to see, because they're very distinct and almost exotic looking. And I think Aubrey Plaza's peepers qualify.
And she's the master of that realm, I would say. She created it.
Right. Yeah. Although it could also be Sid, because she was portrayed as kind of being woke throughout this whole thing.
Mm.
Like, you know, that she was seeing through the illusion from the jump. Mm-hmm. And the only one that really was. Which, that was a great scene, too, when her and, like, Harry's trying to explain to her in the cone of isolation, and she's just, like, three pages ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to find a way to do those kind of expository plot-moving scenes in a fun way, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All right, my number one is Oliver. I guess we've talked some about him, but there just some quirky, funny things. I like that he thought he and David are actually going to start a barbershop quartet. Or yep. He kept being disappointed in little aspects of reality, like he thought they were literally saving daylight, and seems pretty disappointed that his wife isn't Asian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then he's so excited to be, or no, that's Carrie's so excited to be back with him, he's finishing his sentences, which is mm-hmm. an old habit, as he said, and Oliver's annoyed with it. I like that. He describes the Shadow King as he's too virile psychically. That's good.
Right.
And then the whole limerick. And a couple of questions. Is it weird that he hasn't aged while cryogenically frozen? Or I guess that would be expected.
I think that's, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense to me if you're literally frozen.
Comic books.
Yeah.
Now, how he woke up in a cryogenic frozen state and then in the span of it taking them a couple however long to walk back to Summerland, he's cooking breakfast for everybody. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Yeah.
But it is. You know. It's comic book shit, man. Suspension
of disbelief. But
or sci-fi, yeah.
I was thinking about him a little bit. You know, his whole problem was he got addicted to the astral plane and then ended up stuck there. And I think that fits with his character. He's a hedonist. He loves to drink his martinis even while, like, commandos are attacking. He takes a little sip, I noticed, which I loved. But the lure of this reality where he can manifest anything is attractive to him. So now that he's free, is he going to have to be in, like, rehab, you know, astroplane rehab or something like that so he doesn't do it again?
Yeah, could be.
So, is that what happened? Are you asserting that, or is that your theory? Because I feel like it's also plausible to say that he got in prison. He got somehow shanghaied by Walter or the Shadow King.
Oh, the reason why I say that is because of the way that Melanie has talked about him in episodes before, that he liked this reality and then one day he just didn't come back. So I think we've, at least from her perspective, seen that he kept visiting it over and over again because he liked it, but who knows why ended up getting stuck there. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I think the most exciting part about this episode, perhaps, is that Jemaine Clement is going to be in this more in the real world now, right?
Yeah.
He gets shot next episode.
No, come on. They can't do that to us.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. He's great. So, yeah. A few notes. Shorter runtime this week, 43 minutes, which I think was good, actually. Tight episode.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's see. To find out you've had this previously undiagnosed problem since you were a little baby and then there's a possibility of curing it is pretty cool. Like I identify with that. I have amblyopia, so basically my left eye can't focus. And so I was thinking, what if somebody came along and said, hey, check this out. If you do this one thing, you can get rid of that. That was appealing.
I don't know. I think you're risking, you're tempting fate there with your curly hair and your eye. You could turn into a real monster, Jason.
That's right.
Just watch yourself.
I forgot. Right. I do have a special contact, so it doesn't weird people out the milky whiteness of that one eye.
Stay the hell away from me with your leeches, man.
Let's see. I thought it was funny when David slipped into some neuroses there in his psychic classroom saying, maybe they just didn't want me. And rational mm-hmm. David's like, focus. And he goes, right. I am pretty. I am loved. Yep. I am pretty being the most important.
I love it.
Oh, go ahead.
I said the other thing about that, I heard it said because I was not, I was slightly too old and busy being an adult when during the height of the X-Men TV show.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that the chalkboard battle between Professor X and the Shadow King was essentially a shot-for-shot redo of their actual battle in the old 90s X-Men cartoon.
Nice.
It was really cool on the show, too, to see that.
To the extent that that's true, I thought that's a really cool detail.
Absolutely.
Like, above and beyond just the idea of visualizing it on the chalkboard.
It was cool to watch, too. Just how they were fighting, and then... He said,
I thought this episode was was unusually entertaining from a visceral standpoint, as opposed to
which is saying a lot for this show,
right? Because this show, to the extent it's been engaging, has been much more cerebrally engaging, and this was just fun. This was just fun. There's a lot of fun and joy in this episode that's kind of been missing here and there in the season.
Yeah, I guess so. I love that David's sister can't figure out how to make the coffee maker work and put air because she doesn't belong there and she's not special like everyone else.
That's right.
And Carrie versus Carrie. We didn't talk about the Carrie problems that we get this episode. Clearly, the female Carrie is annoyed that male Carrie left her when she needed him. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but there's some animosity there.
Well,
on one hand, I was thinking, yeah, that's a serious transgression and she should be upset. But on the other hand, I'm like, yeah, she needs to face some challenges on her own and grow a little bit.
Yeah, to the extent that I've identified her as the couch surfing, grasshopper to the adult Carrie's hardworking aunt. My patience for her kvetching and bitching and moaning about him abandoning her when ultimately that led to all their salvation. Like, I feel like this is a short conversation. You abandoned me. No, I followed a psychic submariner to his fortress of solitude. He gave us all this rad weaponry and we fought and beat the Shadow King.
Right. And now we can all live.
And then she doesn't instantly say, all right, it's going to take a while for my emotional self to catch up to the rational self, but I see your point. Like, I fucking hate that shit. I think that's so tedious, especially since she's kind of portrayed as slightly spoiled and, like, head up her ass and naive anyway. Like, I do not want, like, episodes and episodes of the two Carries at war with each other. I think that's dumb.
It's interesting, though, that these two are fighting who are so, you know, important to each other. I mean, they're... inhabit the same body, but I saw an interview with the actress and she was talking about the character and she pretty much said the same thing that, oh yeah, she's kind of emotionally stunted because she only comes out occasionally and it's mostly to learn how to fight.
No, it does seem like she's like a 16, 17 year old. Yeah. And so with a less adjusted life experiences. So I'm grading on a curve, but I'm just saying, like, man, that's sort of my personal kryptonite there.
It seems like it looked like things were about to wrap up neatly until the shit hit the fan at the end with Division 3. And, I feel like there's still some unanswered stuff and I don't know if they're going to talk about that next episode or there's the thing about what, Lenny was saying in the beginning, you know, what did he do with it? But also the whole thing with the world's angriest boy in the world and just that scene that they kept going back to at his childhood bedside with his father with a blurry face. I feel like that still needs to be addressed. Don't you think?
I feel like, so I'm starting to come up with the idea that world's angriest boy shit is all about the Shadow King. He's the world's angriest boy, not David. This is all his baggage.
Okay.
Because, like, and I even wonder, like, all these things, like, it doesn't make sense that his father, you know, like, that he has these positive memories of is also reading him these menacing things about him killing his mother. And also, David didn't kill his mother, right?
We don't know, do we?
Well, I'm sure his sister would have mentioned that, right? At some point, like, especially when she's being especially cruel to him. So I feel like, and that would have come up on the chalkboard revelation. I feel like that this is all his back. And I know it probably seems like I'm cheating, but I have the very barest sketch of the Shadow King. Like, he was not a big part of the history when I was reading up on it. I was just aware of him as a character. So I didn't know his real name. I certainly don't know anything about his deep, sad backstory. But I'm starting to wonder if this angriest boy in the world stuff isn't more about him than it is about David.
Either way, don't you feel like that's material for the show to address?
Oh, for sure. Still. For sure. It's going to be somebody's backstory, obviously.
Yeah. I have one other question for you guys. Since you covered both seasons of Fargo, I think a lot of times when you see a new creation from any kind of an artist, it informs their earlier stuff. Sometimes it actually makes you like the earlier stuff less or more or just changed your perspective. Did that happen with you guys at all with Fargo?
kind of in a negative way that I've come and I've come away from Noah Hawley. Certainly, I'm not going to say he doesn't have talent, and he's pretty amazing, but I don't think he has his own voice. I think he is more interested in aping and exploring other people's voice and sensibilities than he is in coming up with kind of a style of his own.
And so, what can you explain that a little bit more? Like what
yeah, styles? like for example, like I feel like he's heavily influenced by the Wes Anderson kind of palette of things in this. And like when you see the Fargos, there's such a mashup of the Coen brothers' works. To their own detriment, in fact. Like, the biggest problem I had in season two, there's this plot with aliens that was, I feel like he felt like he had to hit because, oh, there's a slight alien flavoring in one of the Coen brothers' films, and I need to get that there. And even if it doesn't make sense in this plot or doesn't say the thing that they were trying to say in that movie, and I'm going to try to shoehorn in it to make it fit. I don't know. Like I said, it's not. I don't want to talk shit about Noah Hawley because I definitely think he's talented. I just kind of, I guess I would like to see him because the Coen brothers, I mean, one of the things I really like about them is they just, they kind of, I guess they have a style, but sometimes they come out with like a Fargo or a No Country for Old Men that's like nothing like anything they've ever done before. And also like, you know, they've also got the Raising Arizona and the Big Lebowski lane. But then they'll come out with an Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is kind of in that same sphere, but also a completely unique look and feel and sensibility to it. And can Noah Hawley do something like that? I don't know, because it just seems like all of his projects intentionally ape other more successful directors and filmographers than him.
Yeah, I could see that.
Do you feel me on that, Jim? Because you're the other Fargo aficionado.
Yeah, I mean, I could see if, you know, people were talking about him in the same breath as like a Scorsese or a Wes Anderson or anybody who's really kind of defined cinema or television in the way that those kinds of people have, maybe he wouldn't be uttered in the same breath yet. You know, it's that old adage, the good artists borrow, great artists steal. I would say he is certainly in the good category and firmly in the good category and has potential to move into the great category. But yeah, I guess I would like to see what he could do with a sort of an original IP, right? Like just kind of let him take a project where he wants to take it as opposed to, you know, having this outline with the kind of Fargo stuff or with the Legion stuff. You've got the outlines of Fargo and the brothers in general, and then also the X-Men. So
right, and I guess I'd like to see his next project be something that's like more wholly original.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you, and it's kind of the same way I feel. I was talking about having Jemaine Clement basically doing his comedy in this. It's like, yeah, it feels like it's from something else, but it's so good that I'm okay with it, you know? Same thing with Noah Hawley. Like, he pulls in all these elements that we've seen before, but he does it so well. And one thing that's really helping me appreciate Legion even more than I already did is I started watching Iron Fist.
Yeah.
And so if you want to appreciate Legion more, I would say start watching Iron Fist.
I watched the 2-minute trailer that was they play if you just don't watch Iron Fist, if you just hover on it. And I read Alan Sepinwall's review, and I'm just like, oh, wow. Like, there's a scene where Sir Loras was, like, doing this jumping punch thing at a door, and I'm just like, that is executed so terribly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks pretty bad. Have you made it through the whole way?
Yeah, well, no, I'm, like, halfway, but it is enough, like, potato chips that I probably will finish, but
right,
groaning the whole time.
right.
So anyway, all right, good. Or do you have any more notes about this app?
I have, but it's spoiler type of stuff.
I have one more note.
Save it for the end, Jim.
One more note. I think that Oliver has really picked the perfect drink for his situation. He's picked a drink that traditionally doesn't have any ice in it, that always needs to be icy cold, though. And so the martini is like the perfect drink for this guy. Fits his time, fits his look, fits everything.
Oh, actually, there's two other things I want to talk about that is not spoiler. I just want to ask what the audience to speculate, because I haven't had a lot of time to think about this. This is something I want to kind of research more for next week. But I noticed there was a couple of minor notes, like when Lenny was going to assault the Eye and Sid and Carrie, she has this old-timey flashlight that says USS Ambush on it. Hmm. And I wonder,
what is that from?
I don't know, because I spent all my time researching the next thing, which is there is a poster in the mental hospital where Lenny was hanging out that said Enceladus, which I looked up, which is the one of the six moons of Saturn, but it's also a Titan from Greek mythology. The Titans, you'll recall, were the offspring of Uranus. Just so I don't get the Uranus joke and Jim giggles for 15 minutes. it was the offspring of the tried to dethrone the Greek gods, and ultimately they prevailed. And Enceladus was the chief antagonist of Athena, who is the goddess, you know, of wisdom and warcraft and StarCraft. And Koreans everywhere. No, goddess of wisdom, craft, and war. And I wonder what that means. Like, is Athena Sid here, that she's battling this giant for the control of David? Who is Athena in this situation? That's the opposition. I think that, you know, the Titan is obviously the Shadow King. Mm-hmm. Even the way they drew him, he's just this monstrous, just this thing that's like, you know, size of King Kong over David's house and whatnot. And I was wondering, like, I didn't have enough time to like get lots into research, but I thought some of those like background details might be hints for where they're going towards season. I mean, you never know Noah Hawley. They could be hints for season two, or they could just be stuff that he threw up there because he likes it thematically and how it reinforces the story he's telling.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, now I'm done.
Yeah, I think she seems to be the most Athena-like of anybody, assuming Athena needs to be a woman.
Although I guess if you were going over the goddess of war, Carrie. Huh? Yeah, I was going Carrie's the other direction on that.
Right.
And she seems to have some kind of transformative event. Like, you know, that might be the first time she's alone, but she's actually felt fear. It seemed like that's something that's going to launch an arc for her.
Yeah. I really do think that will end up being good for her, as cruel as that might sound.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to be chased by a horrifying mental rapist through a desolate astral planescape. It
builds
it's
character.
Grow as a person. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. All right, edit that part out. No. Okay, good. Let's move on to listener feedback. I'll go first. Tiffany Thames says, "Guess David's going to let the Shadow King out to handle those guys." That was her take. Be interesting to see if that's actually true.
I mean, I thought it was pretty ballsy for Division 3. Like, surely they know what happened at the headquarters. Like, hey, this guy blasted us all through concrete to hell and back, and we're going to show up with our same guns and not get turned into silly putty instantly.
Yeah.
I guess the big question is David without the Shadow King going to be able to handle these guys, or is he going to have to let, like Tiffany says, the Shadow King off the hook to handle them? Mm-hmm. Or does something else happen?
Yeah, I want to comment on the teaser, but I'll save it for the spoiler section.
Gotcha.
Next.
Laura Willie Swink says, "For an episode that was more direct and straightforward than any we've seen prior, this episode was insane. Who knew the Eye would go out like a discarded gum wrapper? Aubrey Plaza is hardcore, and if there is a god, Jermaine Clement will be back in season two." Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, Laura. This season two, Jermaine Clement all the way.
Yeah, even if there's no god, hopefully.
Yes. Yeah, maybe the god is Jermaine Clement. Tiffany Holland, "Hello, everyone. I really enjoyed the show tonight. Too bad it takes six episodes to really enjoy it, though, but I always give a show at least one season before I quit. I got to say, the way they brought the storyline together gave me a lot of clarity. Finally, you guys told us who the yellow-eyed demon was, but to actually see things play out worked for me. All in all, an amazing episode. I will definitely be watching next season. I still don't understand all those people that are encircling David in episodes 1 through 3 screaming at him, though. I'm not sure. I don't know. That could be just a representation of what it's like to be an untrained raw psychic in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what it feels like, to have just people you know, screaming and yelling at you the whole time. You can't block out their thoughts.
Or it could be a manifestation of the Shadow King fucking with him. Or it could be something else.
Yep. I do want to, because I think that Tiffany makes a strong point here, and I largely agree that this took more episodes than I think necessary to get going. And I'm wondering if, like, even though this was a short 8-episode season, I'm about to commit heresy, but I wonder if I would argue that maybe this would have worked even better as a 7 or 6-episode season. And I understand that the experimental nature of the show makes it hard. Like, if I'm Noah Hall and I'm writing out these scripts and I'm asking for, you know, FX is saying how many episodes he wants to pay for, and he's saying 8, he might think it takes that long because of all how weird it is, and how kind of like otherworldly, and the concept is Parasite, and he has to build that up. And maybe I'm a little impatient because I knew enough about the story to see where it was going a mile away. But I felt like there was at least 1, maybe 2 episodes where they could have gotten rid of, tighten it up a little bit, mm-hmm. and been a little bit more entertaining. But I don't even know how would you do, like, if you decide, if you ordered 8 episodes and you only need 7, do you go back to FX and say, I'm gonna like to return this episode, go contact all your advertisers and tell them to fuck off, it's cool.
I don't think you can do that.
I don't think so either.
But I think that Howley planned it all out beforehand and had it sketched out, and he's probably satisfied, even though some of us might not be.
Yeah, I mean, the only place that I thought, you know, it dragged a little was maybe they slow rolled kind of what is, what isn't real, kind of getting into us knowing that there was a parasite in David that was causing his odd behavior. But you know, I still enjoyed those episodes. It was just, you know, as we mentioned, a little difficult to talk about on a podcast, and it was a little confusing and maybe slightly slower than a pacing I would have liked, but not too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'm fine with it, you know, going into these final few.
And I think, yeah, you could definitely make that argument from a plot standpoint, but for me, even every episode was enjoyable, even though maybe it didn't advance things much. Just for other reasons.
Yeah, I know structurally, it's like if you had them do 1 memory session where they found out about, you know, Lenny and Benny and the Ice Cube guy. And, like, I get you. It's like it's sometimes like maybe it's too thin, but if you packed it all together, it would be way, way too dense.
Yeah.
And people would be like, what the hell? Like, it's just, there's expository galore stuff going on here.
Next season, I'd like to see more story packed in.
Yeah. A little tighter.
Yeah. Okay. Rima Joe says, so many great things in this episode, I can't list them all. This ep gave us lots of answers and some clarity to what has actually been going on, and it was so cool seeing David finally put the pieces together in the classroom. And did I hear a Sir Patrick Stewart impression come from Dan Stevens during that scene? Yes, absolutely.
I'll co-sign that.
Side note, I love the random ding of a bell throughout this and other episodes. Is there a pattern to these? Did I hear that? I don't remember hearing that.
I don't either.
Ding.
Are you sure there isn't a bell ringing in your house somewhere?
Yeah, that does sound familiar, but it was always like... Wasn't it like when, like, wasn't there a ding that played when, like, Carrie let her out of the box and she came back into the psychic ward? I kind of feel what she's saying, but I can't quite put my finger on it because I wasn't paying attention to it as meaning something. It's more just like, you know, a transition kind of thing.
Anybody else has any insights on that? Let us know. All right, there's a couple news items. They're not spoilery, so I'm going to read them now. First, LATimes.com says Legion is going to relocate production to California as part of the latest round of the state's tax incentive program. They'll get an $11 million tax credit.
Where was it? Was it Vancouver?
Yeah, Vancouver. Okay. And I couldn't see where in California. I don't know if it's necessarily Los Angeles, but it makes me wonder about Summerland. Will that be gone and done with or what?
Mm-hmm.
This brings a total number of relocating series to 11 since California expanded this program in 2015. So this next one is not Legion news, but I just happen to see that another series that's going to be shooting in California, it's a new one because of the tax credit, is called Here Now. It's created by Alan Ball, who I was really stoked to see because he made my all-time favorite show, 6 Feet Under.
Ah.
I love that show. And True Blood, which was pretty good in the beginning. It stars Holly Hunter and Tim Robbins. It says philosophy professor Greg Bishop and his lawyer wife Audrey Beck are socially conscious idealists who decided to build a family by adopting children from Vietnam, Somali, and Colombia before having their own child in their 40s. This seemingly perfect progressive family is in actuality harboring deep rifts. Then one of the children begins to see things others cannot. Is it mental illness or something else? I mean, I'll watch anything just because he made it, so I'm looking sure. forward to that. And podcasting on it, possibly. All right, so there's going to be some spoilery stuff at the end, but in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us for this last episode, you can email us at legion@baldmove.com.
Or you can find us on the web at facebook.com/legionpod.
And be sure to check out all of our other great shows at baldmove.com and podcastica.com.
And just the fact that I gave you that line all season shows how much I trust you, Aaron.
And your trust was not poor, was not properly placed, because I manipulated to my own ends for several episodes. It's like I'm bored with the concept. Wasn't to spare your feelings. I was kind of like, I can't do this for, you know, this is us unzipping our suits again for Breaking Good that lasted for like 3 episodes. Like, this is dumb. We can never keep shtick going.
Yeah, well, you know, everything has a life to it. You don't need to prolong it. I mean, maybe they should have, canceled that 8th episode of Legion, but.
Just end it here.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Next week on Legion, this is it's just full on spoilery. So if you don't like that, you should just move along and come back next week. So the grand finale, Chapter 8, is written by Noah Hawley and directed by Michael Uppendahl. So they get their heavy hitters in there. There was a teaser. It's Melanie talking to that interrogator dude saying, "You were right about David. He's a world breaker," which it seems like they're colluding. I don't know. Then there's a bunch of Division 3 goons, a couple dozen, stacked up on their sides. It almost looks like they're part of this same living organism, but I'm not sure. But they're flailing all around and screaming. And Sid says, "The power is real. You got to accept it. I don't care if you save me, save yourself." And then this interrogator guy says, "Look at you, you're gods, and someday you're going to realize you don't need to listen to us anymore." And David says, "Well, isn't that the history of the world?" And he's in his sort of supervillain mode. So it looks like a big confrontation with Division 3 next week. And the teaser didn't totally grab me, but, you know, we'll see.
I do think that... it does answer my question about, like, you know, what David's going to do. He's going to wad these guys up in a little ball. I also thought it's funny that, like, he cleans house on the guys that take a paycheck. But the real big bads are like, okay, now that we've dealt with the mooks, why don't you guys come inside for a cup of coffee and we'll just talk things out. I'm... So, you know, when I was watching Legion, I thought I was going to deal with this with the story of a mentally ill mutant that had multiple personalities.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm wondering if we're not going to, like, backdoor that in the final, like that David's going to, because I've also had this idea that maybe, like, he absorbs Sid somehow, and I thought that was going to be the way this gunshot was going to be played out. Mm-hmm. But and I'm like, well, I guess the RIP that theory. But then when I saw that preview and she's like, I don't care if you save me, you got to save yourself by using your powers. I wonder if it's going to happen like that anyway. Mm-hmm. And she'll be one of the first absorbed personalities, and he's going to have. And then he's also got the Shadow King that will be returning, you know, personal character in his mind. And maybe this eye, like, it'd be interesting if, like, throughout the seasons, he acquires more and more of these personalities he absorbs. you know, I'm doing a lot of theory crafting here. I understand that.
I mean, that's and spoiler territory, guys, but that's the character in the comics. From what I remember, he's got a bunch of people living inside of him and they all have different powers.
And is it he's like, is his power absorbing those people?
I don't remember. I think, yeah, maybe they're dead. Or their bodies are gone.
Uh-huh.
And some of them he's killed. This is all just vague because this was like 25, 30 years ago. But
yeah, I wasn't a big lead, but all the promos made it seem like it was a split personality thing. And we haven't really got that.
So that's why I'm saying, you know, in season two, they still have a lot of fertile ground to cover because they could still go into that and you could find out that all these people yelling at him are part of that.
And it would also be interesting to have a character where he's not crazy to begin with. He's just affected this parasite. He gets cured of that, but then he gets more and more insane as the series progresses because of events that he ends up having a mental illness or a psychotic break or a split personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that would be kind of an interesting way instead of like meeting this character fully formed, actually have him towards the end of the episode. It's the fall of a hero rather than, you know, the curing of one.
Right. Maybe he can get one of his old high school students to help him make meth. I'm just kidding. But that's we like those kind of things. I want to see him go from a scale, of 1 to like 11 on the insanity level. That would be pretty cool.
Right.
What about you, Jim?
Sure, that all sounds great. as long as Jermaine Clement's there, I'm in for season 2.
All right, one more to go. That was fun. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you guys next week.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.